Welcome to session number 355. How does the FLDS Church differ from the LDS Church? Our presenter today is Brian Hales, MD, anesthesiologist at David Hospital and Medical Center. He's the author of Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalism, The Generations After the Manifesto. Let me hold up the book. Available at our booksellers down the hall. If you haven't turned off your cell phones previously, please do so. There is no respondent, and so after Brian is through with his presentation, we will take questions.
Well, I really appreciate you coming. A few months ago, I was approached by Carrie Moore, who is a religion correspondent for the Deseret News. And actually, she called me on the phone and she said, "Brian, tomorrow I'm meeting with journalists from all over the nation, and they want to know the differences between the LDS Church and the FLDS Church." And I'd been working on this book, it was just going to press, and I knew there were a lot of differences between the two religions, but I was unable to just spit out a few of the real primary ones. And I was very frustrated with myself when I got off of the phone and I really hadn't given Carrie very much good information. So subsequent to that, I went down and put together a more formal list of some of the important differences. And, of course, we hear about Warren Jeffs not as much as we did a bit ago, but he's still in the news quite a bit. And once he gets to trial, we'll be hearing more about him. But it's important to notice, I think, some of the differences that exist. You'll also have to pardon my audiovisual. We got messages crossed, and so we're making do with this stuff that I've brought. But it's easy to understand why the press and others would confuse the polygamy as practiced in the 19th century by church members, John Taylor, George Buchanan, with some of the things that are happening today and the different fundamentalist groups, particularly the FLDS Church. As I said, I think there's a lot of differences, but to understand those differences, we're going to have to talk a little bit about the history of the FLDS Church. And so we're going to just kind of buzz through that, but it'll at least give us some context for talking about the differences. In 1904, Church President Joseph F. Smith stopped authorizing plural marriages prospectively. There may have been a handful or so that were authorized retrospectively up until about 1910, but I believe that he did not prospectively authorized any after April of 1904. Between 1904 and 1921, there were scattered individuals who were practicing plural marriage. They would seal their marriages, sometimes thinking that the church president had allowed them to do it. But there was no organization and there was no leadership during this period. I gave a presentation at the Mormon History Association just a couple months ago on that period, if anyone is interested. But what happened is in 1921, a man named Lauren C. Woolley said, "Hey, I remember back in 1886, I was given authority to continue plural marriage." And I believe that the story kind of evolved over the next 12 years. Originally, he said in the 1920s that he was just given authority to continue plural marriage. And then by 34, he says, "Oh, I was also ordained a high priest apostle and as a member of a council of friends." And those ideas were spelled out in these three publications entitled The New and Everlasting Covenant of Marriage, Supplement to the New and Everlasting Covenant of Marriage, and Priesthood Items. They were written by J. Leslie Broadbent, who was the head of the group at that point, and also Joseph W. Musser. And what they spell out was something that was new. This is my drawing here, but it shows that there is a priesthood organization outside of the church. It is presided over by a council of seven friends, and these men are high priest apostles, or Woolley more commonly called them great high priests. But they were a level of apostleship above anything found in the church, including the Quorum of the Twelve. The senior member of this council of seven, as described in those publications, is the one man who holds the keys of sealing and is also described as the president of priesthood. And this is an interesting title. I'm unaware of it being used in the scriptures or by Joseph Smith or Brigham Young or John Taylor. The scriptures, the Doctrine and Covenants, does talk about the president of the high priesthood. And it's a church calling, and it says the high priesthood is the greatest of all. So exactly how this president of priesthood relates to the president of the high priesthood is not something that I have seen identified or discussed in any of the fundamentalist literature. But we'll notice that this priesthood organization exists outside of the church and superior to the church. It also presides over the kingdom of God, which is the Council of 50. And according to this teaching, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and John Taylor presided not because they were church president or the senior apostle in the church, but because they were secretly also the senior member of this secret council of seven friends. Now, if you want to know more about this, and I'm sorry to put in this shameless plug for the book, but there's quite a bit of information in the book that deals with that. It's available around the corner from Greg Kofor to Kurt Bench. I understand you can also get it on Amazon, and it qualifies for free shipping. So the other thing you can do is go to my website, which is MormonFundamentalism.com, and I do pick up the mail there. So if you write a question, I'll try to get back to you. And a version of this paper can be downloaded from this site if you were interested. Getting back to the history of the FLDS Church, however, from 1921 to 1934, the idea of the Council of Friends was disclosed and expanded. And by 1934, most of the polygamists, probably 80%, 90%, were united behind this idea that Lauren Woolley had authority. Less numbers believed in the hierarchy, like the high priest, apostle, and council of friends, but they were all agreeing pretty much that Lauren had authority to seal marriages. Independently of these things happening up in Salt Lake City, down in Short Creek, Arizona, between 1930 and 35, a bunch of polygamists, just independents who had kind of wanted to do polygamy, were there, and they invited John Y. Barlow and Joseph Musser down, and they came down in 1935, and there was an alignment made, and the outpost was set up there at Short Creek with John Y. Barlow moving there with some of his families quite soon, and Joseph Musser staying up in Salt Lake City. John Y. Barlow presided as a senior member of the Council of Seven Friends for a number of years up until his death in 1949. Joseph W. Musser led the groups from 1949 to 1952, but in 1952 is when he tried to identify Reuben C. Allred as his second elder, meaning that he would succeed him as the presiding authority within this group when he died. And the council members, which had their own seniority, didn't agree with this, and so there was a split. Down in Short Creek, Leroy Johnson eventually became the leader, and he was until his death in 1986. And then Rulon Jeffs stepped forward and led until his death in 2002, and he taught that he was going to give his keys to Christ himself. And so neither of these men called any new members of the Council of Seven Friends, Leroy or Rulon. When Rulon Jeffs died, Warren Jeffs shows up really without any really good claims to authority, because he had never been a member of this Council of Friends that his father had got his authority from, a council that I would suggest from my research really just was created in 1930. But Warren couldn't even claim that level of authority. I'm told that he ordained his brother presiding patriarch, and then his brother ordained him church president. But Warren was the legal president of the United Effort Plan, which was the body that owned all of the property down there. And so he became the leader of the FLDS Church at that point. This is a picture, and you can't see it too well, but this is Lauren Woolley, John Y. Barlow, Leroy Johnson, Rulon Jeffs, and then we have Warren Jeffs down here. And I wish you could see this better. This is an old picture of Short Creek. I'm guessing 1930s or before that, before there had been any development down there. It's a very pretty picture. It's black and white, the original. But so we're getting to the differences. We're going to outline 10 of them. The first one is priesthood authority, and I've kind of talked already about some of the differences. The earlier leaders of the FLDS Church got their authority from this Council of Seven Friends. It was described by Lauren Woolley in the 1920s and early 1930s. Section 132 emphasizes the importance of having proper authority. It says that any plural marriage that is not authorized by the one man holding the keys of sealing is not valid, neither a force when they are out of the world. And so I in all of my research and throughout the book, I emphasize the need to have authority of that one man. We'll talk more about that in a minute. This very busy slide here shows that this is the 1886 ordinations. described by Lauren Woolley here, he called seven members of his council of seven friends. Now, when J. Leslie Broadbent and Woolley died, Barlow called his seven members down here in yellow. And then in 1952, there was a split, and Musser called his own council of seven friends. So by 1954, you've actually got three different groups of council of seven. And these men here were kind of presiding, kind of not. Two refused to be leaders, and then a couple down here were dismissed by Leroy Johnson. But as we, if you can see here, Rulon Jess is the one who outlives everybody, and then his son, Warren Jess, is the leader of the FLDS Church today. And if you have questions, you can go to my website. This is from there. There's a smaller version in the book. But if you click on a lot of these names and stuff, you can get a lot of information. There's links that'll give you some information on that. If we look at the structure and how I think it's kind of changed since the description given by Lauren Woolley and Joseph Musser back in the 1930s, the FLDS Church today has its church president, who is Warren. They have, I think, some counselors and a bishop or two called, but to me there's been quite a change, quite an evolution in what's happened down there, which may have something to do with the Deseret News' report that he actually had wanted to step down as the president. He's really in a difficult position to try to link himself back to his parents, his father's roots, and the authority that came through Lauren Woolley. In contrast, the LDS Church has an orderly line of authority, passing from senior apostle to senior apostle, each serving as the church president in his own time. And at this point, I would like to say that I believe that freelance polygamy really doesn't have a lot of value. If you talk to some of the fundamentalists, I've had at least a couple say, look, you know, if it turns out we don't have authority and that we're wrong, we will die, and Heavenly Father will just, you know, let us join the church in the next life. We'll have proxy work done, and we'll be just fine. I'm not sure that's a good way to approach the issue. In 1847, W.W. Phelps went on a mission with Henry B. Jacobs. They got back east, and he convinced three women to marry him as plural wives. He didn't have authority from Brigham Young, who had the keys at that point. When he got back to Utah, the question was, what was Brigham going to do? Was he going to say, you know, W.W. Phelps, polygamy is so important, I'm grateful that you started it and you're a member now and of the polygamy ranks, and good job. Yeah. But that's not what he said. Brigham Young said that those marriages had not been performed by proper authority, that he had committed adultery every time he slept with the women, and he had W.W. Phelps excommunicated. And from my perspective, it just seems that any marriage that is performed without proper authority would fall into the same category as W.W. Phelps's in 1847. Looking at a second difference between the two religions is the belief that polygamy canons should be continued today. If we look at religious history, we find that there are certain times and places where polygamy may be commanded. Sometimes it's permitted, or sometimes it's not permitted by God. The only time that it's ever been commanded that we have any record of in the scriptures or in religious history is the Latter-day Saints between 1852 and 1890. There's no other time or place where people are actually commanded as a group to be polygamous, but they were then, according to our theology. In the Book of Mormon, Jacob was told by God that I will command my people regarding their marriage practices. Plural marriages are regulated through one man who holds the sealing keys. And there's never but one on earth at a time on whom the power and the keys of this priesthood are conferred. And that's how he's able to maintain a house of order. God, in section 132, it says twice that my house is a house of order. The need for order seems to be emphasized in section 132. Interestingly, if we look at the Book of Mormon, First Presidency Counselor George Buchanan said that the Nephites in the Book of Mormon, according to all that has come down to us, were monogamists. This law was not given to them, as far as we have any account, yet they were a great and mighty people before the Lord. And then we recall, and I think everybody's familiar with this quotation, but Joseph Smith said that I told the brethren that the Book of Mormon was the most correct of any book on earth and at the keystone of our religion, and a man would get nearer to God by abiding by its precepts than by any other book. So history shows that through the one man who held the keys of sealing, the commandment was removed in 1890 through the 1890 Manifesto. And then in 1904, through Joseph F. Smith, I submit that the permission to do it was also removed. Looking at difference number three is the belief that more wives equal a greater eternal exaltation. Now, this idea did not originate necessarily with the fundamentalists. If you go back into the 19th century, there were members of the LDS Church who were polygamists who also seemed to believe that the more wives you get or the more children you have, the greater your eternal exaltation. I'm actually putting together a new book, and it has a whole chapter on this issue. I do not believe that church leaders have ever taught that the more wives you get here, the better off you are in the next life, and we'll discuss that in a minute. But Lauren Woolley taught this, which was a new idea. To be the head of a dispensation, seven wives are necessary. To be the head of a patriarchal order, you must have five wives. To be president of the church, three wives are necessary. And I just don't find this type of an idea taught anywhere by Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, or in the scriptures. I submit also church leaders have never taught that a man gains an eternal advantage by acquiring as many wives as possible. It is true that during the period when polygamy was commanded, that would be 1852 to 1890, full compliance occurred as a man took a second wife, and marrying the third and fourth wives was not necessary. There were times when church leaders did say, go get as many as you want, it is your privilege, but as far as spelling out any advantages to a man who has five wives over a man with three wives, that just is not found so far as I've been able to find in my research. I believe the primary issue between 1852 and 1890 was obedience, not the acquisition of as many wives as possible. Difference number four is the control over marriages, and this has gotten a lot of press and a lot of people talking about how the Warren Jeffs and the other leaders down there have been controlling marriages. They have a unique law. It's not found among the Allreds or the Kingstons or the Independents, and it's called the law of placing. And what it entails is the idea that in the premortal world, these women had promised to marry somebody here, kind of like Saturday's Warrior. I've seen that smile somewhere before. We have a soprano here who can sing the other part. It's not church doctrine, to be honest with you. John Taylor did write a very eloquent piece in, it was published in The Mormon, that reflects this idea. Joseph Fielding Smith said that it may in some instances be true, but it's been taken really to an extreme with the law of placing, and the father and the church leaders are able to determine who this girl, this young woman, had promised to marry, and then they would place her with that individual. In contrast, Brigham Young taught this. He said, I am free, and so are you. My advice to the sisters is never be sealed to any man unless you wish to be. I say to you, high priests and elders, never from this time ask a woman to be sealed to you unless she wants to be. But let the widows and the children alone. So the level of control that we see from the law of placing seems to be quite a contrast to what Joseph Smith and Brigham Young taught. But they actually did arrange a few marriages. But to try and control who's married to who and releasing wives and things of this nature, no, this wasn't a practice that they did. Number five is the issue of defrauding the government. The Arizona Revised Statute states that a parent or any other relative who applies for or receives cash assistance under this title on behalf of a child shall cooperate with the department by taking the following actions. Item number one is providing information regarding the identity of the child's father and mother and other pertinent information. Item number five, in case in which the parentage has not been established, providing a sworn statement alleging paternity and setting forth facts establishing a reasonable possibility of the requisite sexual contact between the parties. And what happens is the mothers of the children will not identify the actual father. So the state can identify him and ask him to start contributing to the maintenance of these children. This was a problem for Tom Green, who it was shown in court that the state had paid out over $600,000 to his wives and his children. But by not identifying the father, by leaving that area blank or putting in a fictitious name, the support of these children and the wives is shifted from the plural husband to the state, to the taxpayer. In contrast, Section 83, verse 2 says, women have claim on their husbands for their maintenance. And that Brigham Young has never, he said, don't marry women that you can't support. And that has been the church's counsel, I think, from the very beginning. Priesthood leaders have never encouraged men to marry wives they couldn't support materially. Looking at difference number six, this has to do with living the law of consecration. Attempts were made to establish the law of consecration in the early 1830s, but no attempt was made in Nauvoo. And neither were there any real attempts made in Utah until about 1874, when the nation had a depression. Section 105, verse 34 says, "And let those commandments which I have given concerning Zion and her law be executed and fulfilled after her redemption." And it hasn't been redeemed still. Difference number 7 is associated with difference number 6 in the law of consecration. It has to do with the control over property. I see a hand.
What does redemption mean in this context?
Well, I believe it would be to have the saints back there and occupying the land. And we're actually going to talk about it a little bit. Yeah. Zion is in Missouri. Good point. Yeah, and we're going to talk about Zion here in just a minute when we talk about the One Mighty and Strong. But difference number 7 has to do with the control over property. And the FLDS has a united effort plan that was organized, I think, in 1942. And what I submit that it does not follow the law of consecration. Actually, the leaders have admitted that this is so, because it's just a holding company for all of the property down there. With the law of consecration, however, what happens is the man will meet with the bishop. He'll bring all of his resources with him, and he'll deed them over to the church. So the church will own them, and then the bishop will talk to this man, and he will deed back to the man some of those resources, all of those resources, or all of those resources and more resources, whatever is determined by the both of them, mutually agreed upon, to be his new stewardship. But he is the owner of that, of those property and resources, and then it's up to him, it's his stewardship to succeed or to fail or whatever. But that is how the law of consecration is designed. It's not to give everything to the church and then to go off and become a commune, or for us to live on the church land or something and keep the church leaders in control. It wasn't designed to give priesthood leaders autocratic control over their followers. That was not the design. And yet it seems down in Colorado City to have occurred that between the law of placing and the United Effort plan, the church leaders down there have just incredible control over the wives, the families, and where they live and their homes, just almost everything. And I would contrast that to something that Paul said in 2 Corinthians 3 and 17, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. I just don't see a lot of this free agency down there in Colorado City in the FLDS religion. Difference number 8 has to do with missionary work. From the very beginning of the fundamentalist movements in the 1920s, I don't think I have seen one instance where the fundamentalist leaders have sent out missionaries to baptize for the remission of sins. Section 84, verses 75 and 6 say, "The gospel is unto all those who have not received it. But verily, I say unto all those to whom the kingdom has been given, from you it must be preached unto them." And I believe it's saying here that where the kingdom is, there will be missionaries sent out. And it will always be that way. Doctrine and Covenants 18, verse 15 says, "And if it should be that you should labor all your days in crying repentance unto this people, and bring saved be one soul unto me, how great shall be your joy with him in the kingdom of my Father." Leroy Johnson, who was the leader down in Colorado City from 1952 to 1986, he changed that. He paraphrased it saying, "Let us look to our own selves. If we labor from now on and save no one but our own souls, how great will be our joy in the kingdom of God." And I submit that this is a great contrast to the church and to Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and John Taylor, and leaders in the church even today. When I was a missionary many years ago down in Venezuela, I bought two English Doctrine and Covenants, and I bought a box of envelopes, and this was before the topical guide had come out. But I wrote on the front of these envelopes different gospel topics like plan of salvation, millennium, word of wisdom, missionary work. And then over the course of several months, I would just cut out the even and odd pages, and I'd take those verses and I'd stick them in there. So if I want all the verses on plan of salvation, I could just grab that envelope and go through them. Well, when I was done, guess which envelope had over twice as many verses and pieces of paper in it as any other envelope? The envelope marked missionary work. I know that the polygamists today want to be called fundamentalist Mormons, and I don't mean any disrespect when it's hard for me to use those terms, because for me, if someone is actually going to be a fundamentalist, they're going to be doing the fundamental things that this church has taught, and nothing is more fundamental in my mind than missionary work. And yet, as I research the past of the fundamentalists, or as they are called, I don't see them doing any missionary work at all. And to me, that's troublesome, because the one man who holds the keys of sealing to seal a plural marriage also holds the keys of the gathering of Israel. It is his responsibility, a burden that he feels on his shoulders, I would guess, to try and get this message out through missionary work. It would cause him to send out 60,000 missionaries throughout the world or something like this. And in conjunction with this same issue is the issue of temple work for the dead. The fundamentalists have never had this to be a priority. Joseph Smith taught, "For him to whom these keys are given, there is no difficulty in obtaining a knowledge of the facts in relation to the salvation of the children of men, both as well for the dead as for the living." So the man who holds these keys is able to understand what needs to be done on earth for the living and the dead, to do proxy work and to do missionary work. But again, there's a claim by the men to have had the keys, but they aren't using those keys to do this work, and I'm troubled by that. Section 128, verse 15, Joseph Smith said, "Let me assure you that these are principles in relation to the dead and the living that cannot be lightly passed over as pertaining to our salvation, for their salvation is necessary and essential to our salvation." Just an emphasis on the need to do work for the dead. But here we go. This is a photograph of the temple, the FLDS temple, that has been constructed down in Texas. And I have to hand it to Warren Jeffs. Here's a guy who shows up at the end, at his father's death, and there's no real identified leadership. Nobody's been appointed to lead the FLDS down there. And he shows up without any real defensible claims to a priesthood authority, but instead of just hunkering down in a defensive posture, the guy excommunicates all potential rivals, and then he buys land in Texas and runs off and builds a temple down there. I mean, you've really got to hand it to him. He's very forward-thinking, very proactive. He's got his followers going after incredibly new ideas and things. Very impressive to me. But I will add that temple building has never been part of the FLDS tradition. There is a temple that was prophesied to be built on Berry Knoll, which is located between Centennial Park and Colorado City. But there's nothing about building temples in Texas. What they're doing in this temple and what authority they're doing it by, I do not know. They're very, very secretive, understandably. The last difference that I want to mention has to do with the one mighty and strong. There is no other scripture in Mormon fundamentalist literature that is quoted more often than D&C 85, verse 7. It says, "And it shall come to pass that the Lord will send one mighty and strong, holding the scepter of power in his hand, clothed with light for a covering, whose mouth shall utter words, eternal words, while his bowels shall be a fountain of truth, to do two things, to set in order the house of God, and to arrange by lot the inheritances of the saints, whose names are found, and the names of their fathers and of their children, enrolled in the book of the law of God." Now, in fundamentalist literature, the first duty, to set in order the house of God, is talked about all the time and referred to over and over and over. The second duty is almost never mentioned. I think I found one reference by Joseph Musser in Truth Magazine once, but it's just never included. When we talk about the one mighty and strong in fundamentalist literature, we're really only talking about the very first duty, to set in order the house of God. And the question comes up, what does that mean? Well, Ogden Kraut, who I think everybody loved, a really nice man and an independent fundamentalist, he had this to say. He said, "The setting in order of the house of God will be a greater event than the restoration. The miracles will be greater. The number of converts will be more numerous. The power and the wealth of the saints will be richer. And Zion, the New Jerusalem, will finally be built." End of quote. Modern polygamists proclaim that through the efforts of the one mighty and strong, they will be vindicated, and the practice of plural marriage will be restored. A sweeping transformation of the Mother Church is also anticipated. Now, that's a big job for the one mighty and strong. I think that to really understand what that verse is saying, we might want to make sure we stay in context. The verse was written in conjunction with some problems occurring in Zion, and this is a photograph of the Plat of Zion, which is Independence, Missouri. And if we look at a close-up, we find that here are the inheritance lots all the way around here. In the middle, we find three blocks that are set out. And there's lots of dots right here. Those dots represent the temple complex that's going to be constructed there in Zion, or in Independence. And what we notice is that all of the inheritance lots, that their boundary lines are parallel to these three central blocks. In other words, before you could assign an inheritance lot, you've got to survey these blocks. You've got to survey this temple, this house of God here, before you could do the second duty. And I submit that to set in order the house of God is nothing more than simply to survey the temple. I see a hand.
If you go back to that previous slide, what are the dimensions of that entire depiction?
Of these two blocks that have the temple on it?
No, the entire...
I don't know.
Okay, what about the blocks? The temple blocks?
If they parallel Salt Lake, then you'd have 8 blocks to a mile, but that's a guess.
Okay.
I don't know.
It just looks small. You know, it looks like not many people are getting inheritance.
Well, he says that it looks like from the drawing there's not too many people getting inheritances. There's other descriptions that I discuss them actually in my book in a little bit more detail. Obviously, you would have to expand out from this. But the point that I'm making is the letter from which the verse on the one mighty and strong has come from was dealing with this right here. We were talking about this. W.W. Phelps believed that the one mighty and strong is Adam, that he was going to come back as a resurrected being, that he was going to help survey the temple and make these assignments. If we want to say that the setting in order is actually something that occurs outside of this, we're going to have to concede that before the second duty can be done, somebody's got to survey the temple, and which I believe is nothing more than set in order the house of God. There are other important differences between the FLDS and the LDS Church. I believe they have very little in common today. We've talked about 10. There are other things that we could talk about. I believe that the true priesthood authority and the sealing keys are still held by the LDS Church president. That's my belief. However, I want to emphasize I'm very comfortable letting other people disagree with me. When Greg Coford asked for a photograph of to put on the dust cover of this book, I sent him two. I sent him the one that they've used here, and then I sent him this one. it's me with the target face for those that are listening. I have had some hate mail to my website. Gratefully, nothing as of late, but it's always a concern to me. If somebody wants to disagree, feel free to do so. Thank you.
If you want to ask questions, if you would come to the mic and speak into the mic, and we'll go ahead and have Brian answer any questions that there are.
My question is rather simple. As I understand it, when Joseph Smith started practicing polygamy in 1832 or 33, whatever it might be, and then the Doctrine and Covenants section 132 was presented, in 1843,
July 12th.
About then, to justify his practice of polygamy, and that he received that commandment. That is still in the canon of the Mormon Church today, the LDS Church today, quite obviously not practiced, but yet it's been left there. Is that in the canon of the reorganized church or the fundamental church, or do they pay any attention to the Doctrine and Covenants at all? Especially that particular point of it.
Okay. I think you referred to as the reorganized church have section 132. They do not. And for decades, they wanted to say that Brigham Young had started polygamy, but they seem to have backed away from that position in the last probably 15 years. With respect to the fundamentalists, they do quote section 132 a great deal. And it was polygamy that was a question that brought that forth. Joseph was asking about polygamy. But the answer that came, if we look closely at section 132, the first, verses 3 through 34 don't speak about plural marriage. They speak about eternal marriage. Now, the fundamentalists, the polygamists today, want to say, no, that's also talking about polygamy, but the words are not used there. It's talking about eternal marriage, in which plural marriage is a subset. It's a principle up to the doctrine. The doctrine is eternal marriage. And so, because those verses up to verse 34 don't really specify polygamy, they don't talk about them a great deal in the fundamentalist literature. But then we get to the verse where it says, go ye therefore and do the works of Abraham. That verse is quoted quite a bit, because to do the works of Abraham is interpreted, go out and be a polygamist. And on that point, I would just say that doing the works of Abraham is important. He did a lot of good works, far more than polygamy. But his polygamous wives were given to him by proper authority. In addition, Abraham offered up burnt offerings. I don't know of anybody who's offering up burnt offerings. So if we want to do all of the works of Abraham, we're going to have to go out and do burnt offerings as well. But his plural wives were given to him by proper authority, which means we can't go out and freelance polygamy and think we're doing the works of Abraham.
Could you please discuss the role of the Adam-God doctrine in the fundamentalist church? And do they, separate question, do they still not finish houses for the purposes of avoiding property tax?
Let me answer the second one first. As far as do they not finish their houses, I'm not sure how much of that is tax-related as it is that they don't believe in getting any mortgages for their home, so they just build their homes as they get the income to do it. As they get the money, they'll build on here and they'll try to finish there. If there's a tax advantage to that, that may be a second reason that they're approaching it that way. But if you go down to Colorado City, you'll see a number of homes that are just not very far along and in different stages of construction. The issue of Adam God has Max Anderson, who wrote polygamy story fiction, in fact, once told me he thought it was the number one missionary tool of the Mormon fundamentalist movement was the Adam God doctrine, because you can show that Brigham Young gave some teachings that seemed to contradict himself and seemed to contradict Joseph Smith and the scriptures and John Taylor. And if we just isolate these, and there's maybe a dozen that are fairly explicit, one or two of those was actually published and probably was reviewed by Brigham Young. Most of them you could say, look, this is a, we don't know if this is really what he meant by that, but there's something there that Brigham taught that is hard to understand in light of what else he taught and what Joseph Smith and the scriptures teach, particularly the Pearl of Great Price. The way I deal with it is that if I have to choose between this dozen or so teachings that teach one idea of Brigham Young, and then on the other side I've got Joseph Smith, the scriptures, Brigham Young again, John Taylor, I just have got to choose the second group. That's where I'm going to put my money for now and just wait. It's not something I've been able to fully correlate to.
So they are rock solid.
Oh, with respect to the fundamentalists, yeah, they're very happy just ignoring the Book of Mormon, the Pearl of Great Price. Everything Joseph Smith stated on Adam, I submit, has to do with the Orthodox teaching. The Church, the LDS Church, embraces today. They're very comfortable setting that aside and going with this dozen or so statements from Brigham Young. Don.
Hey, Brian. I had a comment and then a question. I had a chance to interview Ruland Jeffs a few years before he passed away, and specifically I asked for his view on the split between the All Red Group, the United Apostolic Brethren, and the Colorado City Group, FLDS, he headed. And he seemed to have come up with a whole sort of new theology of priesthood to explain the differences between the two groups and explain and account for the split. One of the things that he said is in 1880, Wilford Woodruff had a revelation. Even though Woodruff was not at the time the presiding member of the 12, John Taylor was, and he felt that revelation was from that point where it began to address the entire 12 was from Satan, and that actually the keys were not shared, but they were held, as was taught, sort of that the whole quorum had them or something, but they were exclusively the property of this one man, and in order for them to be passed on, it wasn't enough for him to just die and leave them to, you know, another member of the quorum. He had to designate a successor, which would definitely put Warren Jeffs in a hard position. But he, my friend and I who were there, we asked him if he was the last one of the council that had been ordained, and he said, he looked at us and said very deliberately, "I'm the very last one." And I thought that he would eventually, like, give these keys to someone else before he died, but perhaps the significance of that at the time was he was just planning to take him with him, you know, or, I mean, well, give him to Christ before he went or something like that, you know. And then my question is, I guess you'd have to use some inference and probably a fair amount of speculation on this, but having studied the history of Mormon fundamentalism, as you have, having looked into the FLDS, into the life of Warren Jeffs and Lorne Woolley, I'd be curious what you think the motivations are for, let's say, Warren Jeffs and perhaps also the earlier sort of founder, Lorne Woolley. What are their motivations in their quote-unquote prophetic careers?
That's an interesting thing. How do I read Lorne Woolley to address that? I think Lorne Woolley was a very kindly gentleman who had a lot of stories to tell. And he wasn't alone. There was a John T. Clark who had a lot of very interesting stories to tell. The difference between the two was that Lorne C. Woolley had Joseph Musser. And Joseph Musser wrote down Lorne Woolley's stories. And one of those stories that Lorne taught was that back in 1886, he had been in a special meeting with John Taylor, and John Taylor had given him authority. And then over the course of 12 years, that authority evolved into him becoming the one man. When Lorne Woolley first was teaching about this authority in the early 1920s, he didn't say, look, I am the one man, or actually it would have been his father. His father died in 1928. But according to the story as it's described in the 1930s and beyond, John W. Woolley was the one man holding the sealing keys in the early 1920s. I can find no accounts of his father saying that or testifying to that fact. In fact, when his father was excommunicated in 1914, he said he got his authority through Matthias Cowley. I can find no account that John Woolley said that he was the one man holding the sealing keys, but Lorne Woolley later made that claim for him. And I believe that Lorne was just a kindly guy who had the right story at the right time, and then Musser took it and ran with it. Interestingly enough, the idea of the Council of Seven Friends and High Priest Apostles is not embraced in the same way that it was taught in the 1930s. I see a hand, and then we'll need you to come up to the mic so we can get it on there if that's okay, so they can get on the tape.
It's slightly extraneous, but I just wanted the relative parallel. Joseph, before he died, had hedged his bets a number of ways. And one of them, he set up a council of seven to hold special keys in case everything was wiped out from the formal organization, it could be recast. And that's the item that the Cutlerites hang everything on, that Cutler was the seventh. But from the LDS Church point of view, John Smith was the sixth. And he decided there was no need for this Council of Seven, and he went out to be Brigham Young's patriarch. So there was a precedent for having such a restoration in case of disaster. But the example from Joseph's time...
You mean Joseph Smith.
Joseph Smith's time. Because his uncle was one of those designated. He designated seven people who were outside of the highly visible. You know, they weren't members of the quorum, they weren't members of the first presidency, but they were significant players like Cutler and John Smith and five others. But when the need for that was gone, it resolved back. As far as John Smith is concerned, there was no need for it. As far as Cutler was concerned, he was left out. There was a need for it.
Well, and on that point, with all due respect, there's a lot of things that are written regarding John Smith and the presiding patriarch office and other things. I haven't found anything that's convincing to me that actually occurred, though I respect other people who want to believe that way. And I would offer up D. Michael Quinn has looked at that period after Joseph's death and all of the different groups that might have evolved to control the church and membership. And I've talked to him personally about this. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of information to support that. And if you have some things, I'd love to see it. But again, in my research, I haven't found that. So,
Steve Johnson, could you repeat or summarize what you said up to this point? I missed your opening remarks. It appears that the argument made by the FLDS is that John Taylor ordained somebody, gave them special keys, and these keys have been passed down. So the question is this really true? What evidence do we have that it's true? Why would it be true? Wouldn't it be contradictory to establish principles, et cetera?
In 1991, Mike Quinn said that 90% of the fundamentalists ascribe their authority through Lawrence C. Woolley. I did talk about that. There's quite a bit in my book. That's where I'd probably send you over to the website if you want to go to there. It's MormonFundamentalism.com. But Lauren Woolley claimed to have this authority in 1886. I've looked at the men that he says were ordained, their lives. I've looked at his life. I've looked at everything. I'm just not the least bit convinced that there were any ordinations. There definitely was probably a revelation, and we don't have time to talk about here, but it doesn't say that you can never suspend the practice of polygamy. It says a lot of different things, but it doesn't spell out those things. It's written in ambiguous language enough to allow the manifesto to occur 4 years later. Oh, okay. But as far as Lauren Woolley goes, I just think he was a kindly old storyteller with the right story. So, to John Taylor, it was a personal revelation, but the information that is useful. And I discuss it in detail in my book, and it's on the website, too. So,
this is a point on the succession crisis you just alluded to. If I'm not mistaken, in Andrew Ehat's master's thesis, he makes the argument that the two counselors in the first presidency did not have their second anointings, whereas the 12 apostles did have their second anointings, and he cites that as one of the supports for the fact that the Brigham Young and the 12 retained the authority, the most authority in the church, and therefore had it. I don't know if you've read that.
Well, it's a very good point, and to me it really defines the only group that could possibly have been running the church after the death of Joseph Smith, and it was those individuals who had received all of the temple ordinances and had the authority. And that was a select group. There were an awful lot of men in that group that had received all of their temple ordinances. And Brigham Young had been specifically designated, I think Ehat says, to give the temple endowment ceremony to the other members of the Quorum of the Twelve and a few other there in Nauvoo, so that he would be able to do that after Joseph's death. And I don't think Quinn really emphasizes that point as much as I would. I just think it excludes everybody else. Okay, they had the knowledge and they had the authority. You know, we can talk about six or seven other pathways for leadership to go, but to me, I just don't know what they would have done about those two issues.
I think it comes mostly from Ehat's thesis, his master's thesis, not Quinn's. I know that Andy
Yeah. Yeah. But Quinn doesn't emphasize it as much as I think Andy does, and I think it's important. So.
I may have missed it. I was like 2 minutes late, but I'd be curious to know how your profound interest in this developed.
I get asked that all the time, and it's a very good question, especially when my bishop asks me or, you know, somebody. I have a sister who was excommunicated for joining the All Red Group back in 1989, and she sent me all their literature, and I read through it, and I sincerely prayed, is this the right way? But from the very beginning, I could never be convinced about this issue of the one man holding the sealing keys. And some people will say, well, no, it's still Joseph Smith, and he's passed on. Well, there's one man on earth, and I think that on earth means he's still here. But if it doesn't, Joseph Smith is where Elijah is, and that's where he got the authority, so there would be two men wherever Joseph Smith is. So I believe there's one man on earth at a time, and the key for all of us is to find out who that one man is and follow his teachings. If he's allowing individuals to practice plural marriage today, we need to do it. But if he's not, freelancing plural marriage, I believe, doesn't bring any advantage. So,
I had a question. You implied, and I don't know how much research you've done to flesh that out, that William W.W. Phelps being excommunicated because Brigham Young didn't authorize the marriages, that implies that Brigham Young authorized all marriages, the plural marriages, and I don't know how consistent that is throughout the history of everyone that was getting married.
It's a very good point. I think during Brigham, you know, I'm not the expert. I should see, Don, do you know, did Brigham Young spread it out? I know in John Taylor's day, he didn't want to know everybody who had authority, and he wasn't worried about authorizing every marriage by name. He said, you know, here's the criteria. You men have the authority. Go ahead and go do it. That was in John Taylor's day. I think things were kept a lot closer to the home, particularly in 1847, before the first presidency had even been organized. So I would bet he was authorizing every plural marriage at that point in time, but whether he allowed that to go beyond his own personal decision later on in his presidency, I don't know. Does anybody?
I had a great,
yeah,
great.
He did.
Did he later on?
He controlled all of that. You know, he resisted the party of Pratt. Ron Anthony talked about this at MK.
Senator Elijah's in Utah. He signs all the permissions. Everything, you know, he's got his staff, like, helping things come in and go out.
This is Brigham Young you're talking
Brigham
about.
Young
okay.
Approves everything.
He approved everything, we're told by, and what's your name?
Mark Asher.
Oh, okay. Mark, I've seen your name.
I, you know, Ron Esplin's the expert on that, those early years, and then in Utah, Captain Danes and Ben Bennion
have looked at that.
My great-great-grandfather was a lifeguard of Joseph Smith, and he was a polygamist in Nauvoo. And he lost one of his wives crossing the plains. When he got to Utah, he took another wife who was a widow from England. And Brigham Young had not given permission, and he was chastised by Brigham Young for not gaining his permission before he took that plural wife. He wasn't excommunicated, but he was chastised.
There was some discipline.
Discipline. Yeah. One issue that I wanted to bring up was that, of course, with John Taylor, he was so adamant about the following of polygamy. And his son was an apostle who was excommunicated because he was also adamant that his father had taken this posture. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
On John W. Taylor?
Yeah.
John W. Taylor, my perspective, and I take this in the book and spend a little bit of time talking about Matthias Cowley and John W. Taylor, my take on it is that they were like other apostles prior to 1904 when Joseph F. Smith said, we're not doing this anymore, April 1904. But in April 1904, afterwards, I think Matthias Cowley and John W. Taylor were different from the other quorum members. Now, there's Gregor Claussen and a couple of question marks in there that I don't know about, but certainly by 1906 or 1908, these two men believed that they could go on sealing marriages, even though Joseph F. Smith, I believe, was not allowing them. And that made them different. And when they were dropped from the quorum, and then later at the 1911 trial minutes shows that he talked about the 1886 revelation, which he said his father interpreted as plural marriage could not be stopped at that time. And I think John W. Taylor was saying, he was saying that the revelation says it could never be stopped. I don't read it that way at all. And so a lot of people said that Matthias Cowley and John W. Taylor were asked to fall on their swords and were sacrificed, and the church gained hugely from a political standpoint from dropping them from the quorum in 1906. But I believe that in addition to that, they were doing things the other quorum members weren't. They were different. That's my take on it. So.
I've got a question on the FLDS. You indicated that one of the differences was the government getting the welfare and so forth. Is there much evidence, Brian, that the FLDS down in Colorado City were getting massive amounts of welfare from states of Arizona and Utah?
Yeah, the question is there evidence that the FLDS down in Colorado City, Arizona, were getting more of the welfare assistance than, say, other towns of that size in Arizona? And the answer is yes. I have to quote John Krakauer, and I'm kind of hesitant to do that, but I think the number he had was somewhere in the high 30 percentile were all getting welfare, whereby in a normal city or town that size, there would be maybe 6 or 8%. And like I say, Tom Green, I think, was over $600,000 that the state had paid for his children, wives.
Regarding John W. Taylor, when he and Matthias Cowley were dropped from the quorum, they didn't go through a church court procedure. They were still members. And John Taylor got nailed for taking a wife, about 1912? According to Sam Taylor's book, on his life. Anyway.
I think it was 1909. I could look it up.
Okay,
He
threw it in their face, basically. Yeah. Took a young wife, and bam. Did Matthias Cowley get excommunicated?
He was not ever excommunicated. He was told not to use his priesthood, which is kind of a unique discipline. But he later was admitted in full fellowship and served a mission to England and died in the church in the 1936.
Well, John W. Taylor was later exonerated, too, but it's posthumously, I believe.
John W. Taylor took his... If Matthias Cowley and John W. Taylor had not been involved with polygamy after they were dropped from the quorum, nothing would have happened to them, but they continued to authorize them and participate with them. Matthias Cowley was a good friend of all the polygamists during the 1910 to 1920 range, and people would come to him, and he'd send them off to Lauren Woolley, according to one of the stories. John W. Taylor was excommunicated in 1911. He died in 1916. Sam Taylor, his son, says that he was approached by the fundamentalist leaders and asked to take over the group. That there was no group. It's anachronistic. There was no group in that time. I believe that's just fiction. But we do have good accounts that the temple work has been done for him, I think, in the 1960s, according to Rulin Allred. And I think there's even an article in Sunstone on that. So, well, another question. We got about 3 minutes. So.
Oh, I was just going to ask you a question that has no merit to it at all. And that is, what does the polygamous group think about Big Love?
What do they think about Big Love? I went to a panel last year that talked about Big Love. And is it a positive thing or a negative thing? I don't want to put you on the... Big Love, the series, the HBO... Well, and what do the fundamentalists generally feel about it? It's a good thing, it's a bad thing, leave us alone, yeah.
Oh, mixed emotions totally. There's some scenes that are very offensive and others that are, I just think, very intriguing. It's a compelling series. I think the actors are wonderful. It's amazing how they work in different true parts of history that have actually happened, like two women shooting, who's the guy? Jordan, no.
Roman.
What?
Roman,
yeah. And I thought, oh yeah, we see two women shot, Rulin Allred, he died, so it must mean it, but he didn't in the show. So they just bring in little snippets of truth, and yet they don't carry it all away because I guess they have to be careful of not coming on too strong about being a factual show. Definitely fiction, and I think it's very compelling generally, but there are some sexy scenes that are very interesting.
If they could take out the soft porn stuff, probably more of a positive reaction from the fundamentalists, you think?
Well, amazingly, most fundamentalists don't have HBO.
Most fundamentalists don't have HBO, she says.
Well,
thank you all for coming.